Call to order the March 28, 2013 session of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are in order. Welcome to all of you this morning. A couple of announcements. Spring has been declared, and we're going to have an Easter weekend with the 70-degree weather. That's number one. Number two, for those of you who've been following GMO and labeling in our committee, we had a preliminary ruling, or opinion rather, by LC yesterday. Preliminary means it's verbal to me. That in fact the ability for the state to regulate GMO and to conduct labeling is constitutional. When that opinion is formalized in writing, we will be sharing it with all of the committee and the public. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing. Temporarily, we're just going to hear a couple of our legislators because Senator Roblin has other business to attend to this morning. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3441. Beth, could you tell us just briefly about that bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3441 would establish the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Board and specify members and duties of that board. There's no revenue impact on fiscal statements in your packet, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, committee members. For the record, Wayne Krieger from District 1's. During the early part of the 2001 legislative session, Representative Morgan, Senator Mesley, and then Director of Department of Fish and Wildlife, Lindsey Ball, met in my office. Mr. Ball at that time presented his vision for a new salmon research center to be located on the LC. We at that time discussed the need for research, the benefit of having science to guide policy and hatchery management practices. And I think this is probably the most important part. Specific. And the major focal point was the question, is there a difference between wild and hatchery fish? If so, what hatchery management practices caused or contributed to the difference? How would we change our practices at the hatchery to lessen the negative effect of hatchery fish on wild fish when they do spawn together on the spawning grounds? The cost of the facility was about $6.5 million. We have spent another $10 million plus operating the facility. What we know today, specific to the reason the hatchery was built, can be printed on a postage stamp with large print. The anti-hatchery mentality at Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has clearly been present and negatively affected the research center's ability to conduct meaningful research focused on the main issue that prompted the research center to be constructed. And even if you agree that there is a negative effect of hatchery fish on wild fish, I would expect that scientists would really want to focus on what is the cause of it. If that question was asked, or if that question was actually affirmative, that what there is negative, the scientists should be very much interested in what is causing that negative effect and then answer the other two questions that I talked to you about. We have both an agricultural research center and a forest research center at Oregon University. As legislators, we have heard many times the need for these centers and that hundreds of millions of dollars of value has come from those, the work that they've done. And there's been great support from all of us. The need to have science drive fisheries management is crucial and supported by all, nearly all of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's constituent base. The bill changes the makeup of the Research Center Board, provides oversight to Research Center's projects and their status. The bill directs that new agreement be negotiated with Oregon State University that reflects the goals of the Research Center. There are numerous changes that are in the bill that over time work in part fishing, some of the constituent base, and I'm going to name just talk just a little bit about a few of those. The original bill took Oregon State University out of the selection of the director of the research center. We've changed that, put them back in there, so they're doing it pretty much in the bill now as they were prior to that time. And we want to make sure that the cooperative agreement also is consistent with the goals and objectives that were in the original agreement and that are in the bill. The other issue was several places we inserted the word policy, and in reality, boards of this type do not set policy. That's done by the director and with the Department of Fish and Wildlife on those types of issues. The word pure in reference to salmon also was taken out. There was also some criticism about the makeup of the board, that it was a lay board and they shouldn't have any authority over, they don't know what they're doing, they're not qualified to really oversee research. The fact of the matter is, the research is going to be done by the same scientists, probably they're doing it today. But there's no scientists on the board, except for the three that can be appointed by Director Elliker from Oregon State One, from Department of Fish and Life One, and a federal one if he wants to put someone on there. I would argue that if they've already had research scientists on the existing board, what good did that do us? $18 million? And like I said, you can put it on a postage stamp. ORS 496275, I'll read you a couple of things out of that. The Legislative Assembly hereby declares the necessity to review all options and means for the protection and restoration of Oregon salmon resource that promote the local economic development and enjoyment by all the citizens of Oregon. Review and revise existing state administrative rules so that the different forms of hatchery production are recognized as necessary to the critical element in the state's salmon production system in order to provide harvest opportunities for Oregon citizens. Inventory other appropriate local sites, identify possible types of production facilities, investigate and implement ways to improve hatchery smolt survival and reduce predation. That would include such things as night releases, net pen acclimations, alternative sites. And all of it must be, and this is, I think, is important, consistent with the conservation of native salmon and genetic resource. And I don't know anybody that that knows this question, has talked about fish, that doesn't value the native fish and understand that we do not. We want to lose them anywhere. We need to enhance their ability to survive. And I think the hatchery can find us some ways to do that. Identify a need of monitoring and evaluation of activities to ensure protection of natural spawning fish population to assess the contribution of such cooperative projects to the public. The department shall encourage and assist in the planning hatchery facilities, and it goes on and on. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, in my own mind, cannot comply with 496275 without a salmon research center. And it shouldn't be on the cut list, which it is too high. We're talking with the department about that and also down in the ways and means process. There's about 48 or 9, I haven't counted, but people that were legislators that signed on to the bill. If Senator Roblin wasn't becoming a grandfather, he would have been taken the bill over to the Senate, probably got us quite a few more names. So it's a great support from the legislative body, both House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats. I want to name just a few of the people that we've been meeting with and who support the bill. And there's some on here, I'll note them, that haven't committed specifically to supporting the bill, but the concept, I'll be meeting with them. Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Oregon Steelheaders, Oregon Anglers, Oregon Salmon Patrol, Joe Redd with Fish Commodity Commissions, Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Forest Industries Council, I believe, is going to. We're having some conversations. Jim Meyer, Native Fish, Tom Wolf, Oregon Trout, Salmon, For All, CCA, Rich Angstrom, Oregon Concrete, Oregon Coastal Caucus. We're looking for a tribal member. We believe we've got one of them on board, that they understand that the research needs to come forward. I really believe when you see the basic 90% of the constituent base that's either dependent on salmon, and that also the coastal ports, I don't think I mentioned them. It's getting to the point where we really need to understand that you have this type of support for a piece of legislation. We need to move it forward. We need to make sure that the department, in fact, does its job. House Bill 3441 will help research and give OSU and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife a direction on research projects. We all need to have open minds and embrace new science to guide fish management. I also met with Brett Brownscombe from the governor's office yesterday and the last week with Richard Whitman. In those conversations, I expressed that I was of opinion that we needed to invest a lot more, not only in the Salmon Research Center, give them more capacity to do research projects there and other hatcheries throughout the state. I really believe that if we have a research center that does the type of work that is approved by that list I just mentioned to you, that they're going to get great support for additional funding, and we're going to try to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Senator Roblin, welcome to our committee. Congratulations on grandfatherhood. Yep. And it's great to have you back in the People's Chamber once again.
And for the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5, I thank you for those comments. And I also want to say this is kind of where my home was when I first started in the House. The Ag Committee is one that I feel very, very close to, and I feel like I'm coming back in the Senate. There's a committee that does a number of the things that you're doing over here. It's not called the same, but we have the opportunity to work with rural issues and issues like this one. You know, the reality is this bill, when it was coming through and we were developing the hatchery, it was clear that it was about finding answers to us about hatchery programs in general. And I was really supportive of it at the time. Our group of Coastal Caucus members actually set up a time to go visit the hatchery when it was in place, and we went over to the hatchery and had a tour by Noakes, who was the director, and he explained at that time that, you know, I can make a fish that's any kind of fish you want. I mean, and if you see this hatchery, it's not like any hatchery you've seen before, because it really takes the river, takes a stream bed, and most of the work takes place in stream beds, so they can see how to do different kinds of things in a natural setting. There's another stream that bypasses it, but they can also make sure that every fish that comes back, they can check. So any of the fish that they let out of that one, they collect their offspring when they come back, and the wild fish get to go through. So it's an amazing thing on ALSI, and I would encourage anybody to go look at it. What I really believe is that there are a whole bunch of answers that we should have. Most of us on the coast really believe that hatchery fish continue to keep an industry going. And I will tell you that the industry off the Oregon coast is kept in business when we get to catch salmon out in the ocean by California. I mean, I hope people understand that it is the Sacramento run that we catch off of here. Our fish that we produce here with our hatcheries for the most part, they get caught in British Columbia. It takes a whole system of us to work together to make sure that this fish is out there swimming and doing the kinds of things and then being caught. However, when they come back, there is a moment in time when the bays and estuaries that are around our state are full of these fish. And Coos Bay has a totally new, because the hatchery's up the river, a totally new energy in our community when you look outside my window at the bay and see it filled with fishing boats, you know, local people going on the fishing. Where you walk on the beach, down along the boardwalk, and there's people casting off the beach catching salmon. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And no one wants to hurt the wild salmon. Everybody wants to make sure that we continue to keep those fish there. This hatchery was our belief that we were going to find answers to. Is there a way we could raise hatchery fish that come back at a slightly staggered time? So we know when the wild fish are coming back, they have a natural time when they come back. Can we adjust these hatchery fish so they come back a little earlier, so that if you do have escapees, they don't necessarily have the opportunity to mate with the wild fish? There are so many answers that science could help us with and give us information about how to make sure that we don't impact that wild salmon population. In Coos County, we always chuckle about wild salmon. If people knew the history of Coos River, it was a splash dam river. So if you understand logging, what they did was they would build a log dam up the river, and then they would cut all the trees on the banks and move them into the river in this big new lake that they formed. And then at a particular time when the mill was ready to have all these down at the end of the dock, they would blast that dam out of the way, and those logs would come roaring down the river. So you didn't want to be on the sides of the river at the time, though there were amazing people that actually would ride some of that. I, to this day, cannot imagine how they did that, because if you missed, you were gone. But these logs would come down, and do you know what that did? It took every bit of gravel in those streams down the river with it. And so there was a time when you couldn't find a fish going upstream because there was nothing to do when it got up the stream. And in Coos River, if you know, it ends on these abrupt big waterfalls. So come and see Gold and Silver Falls. They are beautiful. But there weren't any fish going up those things. So there weren't any fish above that area. And so this whole area kind of got wiped out with respect to having gravel beds and other kinds of things for fish. And we've worked hard to get some of that gravel back, and we have other opportunities, but if it weren't for a hatchery, we wouldn't have had a fish population there. We did a lot of weird things in the past about salmon. You know, most of the salmon that they had in Venezuela and, well, not Venezuela, in Chile and other places came from, Oregon and Washington. They wanted to enhance their deal, so we moved fish eggs around on the West Coast. We did that originally in our hatchery programs, and we came to the conclusion, this isn't really good. You know, these fish have evolutionally designed for these river systems, and we shouldn't be mixing that and maxing. So everybody recognized that there for a while we really did some bad hatchery practices. We've gotten better and better, and that's what this whole hatchery, that's why we invested the money, was to make sure that we had the best science to help us make sure that we kept our wild salmon and enhanced the opportunity for people to catch these other salmon. And we continue to want to have those kinds of things. We believe that by having this board, that's what Oregon does best, getting interested people involved in helping make policy and setting decisions and looking at stuff, is how Oregon answers most of its questions. So we think this is a natural evolution of how this place should work, and we look forward to having the opportunity to have this bill heard in your committee, passed and moved on to the Senate. Hopefully it can come to my committee or another one near me in the Senate, and we can shepherd it along. But I thank you for the opportunity and the time to speak to you today. And again, it's great to see the people who are on this committee, and it's really enjoyable to be here. To know that two of the people sitting up there come from my little community is really a great thing. It's nice to know that we have a good representation from Coos Bay and Coos County. And even though I was not a graduate of Marshfield High School, to know that two of the people sitting on your dais are is really a great and warms the heart.
Iron always a fire.
All roads go through Coos Bay at some point.
And you're a wonderful storyteller, Senator. Thank you. Thank you both very, very much. That was very enjoyable. There is a Dash 1 amendment, and I presume that both of you are in support of that.
We are, and I want to give a lot of credit to Representative Krieger for working on those things and talking to people and taking into consideration issues and ideas that people came forward with and then making adjustments to make the bill, I think, a better bill than it was before.
And Mr. Chair, also, we're probably going to have another amendment, a couple little fixes, and here again, it's accommodating some concerns that a couple of people brought forward. It doesn't really take anything away from the purpose of what we're doing, so we can do that.
Okay, and I'm assuming as well that amendment isn't ready yet.
No.
Okay, thank you. Questions for our colleagues? I'm not seeing any. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3441. And I am going to open a hearing on House Bill 2783. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2783 creates the offense of unlawful tethering of domestic animals. There is a Dash 3 amendment in your packet which makes some adjustments to what constitutes unlawful tethering and what the exceptions are to that offense. There's no revenue impact on the Dash 3 and a minimal fiscal impact and no subsequent referral.
Thank you very much. And we have two people left to testify on this bill from last time. And I'm going to call forward, please, Larry Sola. Okay. I'm going to also call up David Walker. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen, and Mr. Sower, welcome back to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Larry Sower. I'm from Oregon City. I served in this body for 12 years in the late 80s and throughout the 90s. And then I went to the Clackamas County Commission for a few years after term limits got me. In my early years as a legislator, I represented about half of rural Clackamas County that's inhabited by people, not the forest areas. And And as a Clackamas County Commissioner, I continue to represent those people. And I visited, my policy in campaigning was to visit a lot of people and talk to them and hear their issues. In rural Clackamas County at that time, there was a lot of people that lived on small acreages throughout the county, kind of that we went into effect before land use planning. So about half of those people chose to work in Washington County and the Portland area. And so whenever they left for work, generally both people worked, they would take a family dog that was maybe in the house or in a kennel and tie it out around their agriculture buildings to protect their machinery. Things have changed in the last few years. Now a lot of gates have went up around these little farm roads to the access roads to the houses because the Portland area has changed and we're the kind of the bedroom community for Portland. And because of the drug trafficking and things that go on, people don't dare go off and leave their whatever they have, might be a garden tractor or a large tractor if they have areas to farm. So they tie that dog out somewhere near the machinery and stuff so that it was protected. You know, when things have changed now, as the gates went up, the dogs are still there. And those people often go to work and or it may even work in the fields, but a 10-hour day is not unusual for them. And if they get tied up in traffic or their son or daughter has some athletics, they may be gone for more than 10 hours. I want to talk now just a little bit about the Dash 3 amendments. And I really appreciate the committee and the chairman working with people to get these amendments because they make the bill a lot more palatable. But I'm still in opposition because there's still some things that don't work for the common person in Clackamas County. One thing that when I was in the legislature and just about every session we had a bill that said you have to tie your dog if you're riding it around in the back of a pickup. If you know rural people, that's how they transport the dog, just throw it in the back end of the pickup and go to town. Well, we kept saying, well, tie that dog. The original bill would have prevented that from happening in that it said you had to have a 15-foot leash on the dog. And so the dog would, of course, jump out of the pickup the same way it would have been before we started the effort to try to get people to tie. So the amendments, Dash 3 amendments, take care of that. They say if you're transporting your dog or it gives you some leeway on them, let you decide how long that leash would be. So that's a good part of it. I'm kind of here today because I'm a practicing veterinarian and I kind of took a sabbatical when I was in the legislature on the county commission, but I still occasionally get to see a dog that jumps out of the back of a pickup when they're driving and is injured and scuffs up and things like that. So I appreciate that kind of amendment. There is one amendment that concerned me, and that original bill said you can't have a dog in a vehicle. Now, I'm sure the intent was to say they can't spend the night in a vehicle or when nobody's around, but it actually prohibited people from having dogs in vehicles. And hunters and fishermen and everybody that haul their dogs to town or to out in the woods. It would have some kind of a fashioned container. It might be an airport crate, or it might be some kind of a fashioned dog container in a canopy. Dash 3 amendments partially take care of that in saying that there, you have some leeway on hauling a dog around in a vehicle, and I'm a little concerned that state police officer, humane officer, whoever might say, well, even though you think your dog's being taken care of properly, it might be in that vehicle too long or not protected properly. So I had that concern, but we'll work on that at a later date to try to come up with some language that put some guidelines for people to look at. I came here because I don't consider tethering a dog as criminal as a lot of the Humane Society people do. And there's a lot of instances where a dog is tethered for various reasons. I know once I had a dog, well, I still have him, sent to a trainer. And he said, well, I don't tether dogs. Well, we didn't call tethered tying them out of machines. We don't tether dogs. We just put them in that kennel. And after a month, he said, well, whenever I went there, you have kind of a timid dog, and he'd crawl in his doghouse and wouldn't respond to me. So take him home, get a different trainer. But if you tether that dog for a couple, 3 weeks, what we call walk up the chain, and get a hold of the dog and pet him up and feed him and all that kind of stuff, then it works out better. And so it's, tethering dogs is not as criminal as some people would like to make out. And a lot of our hunters out in the field tether their dogs at night. As Ted Draddock from LeGrand said in an article in the Oregonian, that when he works for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, doing all kinds of research with them, with his dogs, they put on tracking collars and all kinds of things. And when he comes home, the dogs are tired and they're glad to get in the dog box, and they don't care whether they're tired or not. They just, it will stay there. So it really puts a hardship on people that work and use their dog to protect their property where they're gone. It really puts a burden on people that use their dogs for hunting and come in and tie them up. So I personally don't tie dogs. I keep them in kennels, but we're going to work as this bill goes through the process to try to get a little more leeway for those people from Clackamas County that will have a hardship and could lose any property. Those people that are on drugs, they'll come and steal you blind. We've had several instances in Clackamas County where they even came and stole the railings off of bridges. They'll do anything to get that money. So,
all right.
Thank you for these amendments, and we hope you'll. They may look at the Dash 3 amendments favorably.
Thank you very much, Representative Soa. Appreciate your comments. Appreciate your appreciation for the Dash 3 amendments. Next, David Walker, and if the remaining witnesses, if you can keep your testimony to a maximum of 3 minutes, I'd appreciate that very, very much, because we have a number of bills we need to get through today. Welcome to our committee.
Yeah, my name is Chair Witt. Committee members, my name is David Walker. I'm from Tillamook, Oregon. I represent the Oregon United Sporting Dogs Association, and we are opposed and have some concerns about House Bill 2783-2, and like Larry said, we do appreciate the changes that you've worked with and made on the amendments. Still have a couple concerns. One of our main ones is one of the ones Larry brought up about the vehicle. It's left open basically to the discretion of whatever officer stops you to decide if that animal's been in the vehicle too long, whether it's been detrimental or not. We're not real comfortable with that language. As Larry said, most of our dogs are hunted and hunted and then brought home and tethered, put away, whether it's in a kennel or chained. And once those dogs have been hunted and worked, they generally, like he said, do not care, and sometimes they'll sleep for 24 hours and not come out of their house. So, you know, we don't believe that also that this bill is necessary. We already have animal cruelty laws that definitely can affect everything that's wrote in this bill. We would ask that actually on the section 2E, it says that an exemption for when a dog is kept for herding, protecting livestock, or dog sledding. And we'd like to add in there hunting dogs that require licensure from the state. There's an amendment here in C above that that says for the purpose of engaging in an activity that requires licensure in the state, including but not limited to hunting. The way I read that, that covers the hunting dogs for when they're actually engaged in hunting, but it doesn't cover them for when they're at home. And so those are my concerns. I spoke with you before. I just wanted to go on the record to reiterate it and tell you where we were at. And I appreciate for the chance to comment.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Vice Chair McKeown, please.
Chair Witt, thank you very much. I appreciate both of you being here today, and it's very thoughtful testimony that you're giving, and I'm grateful for that. But you just raised a question for me that I would like to address. Hunting, I understand you have to have a license. I understand the other provisions of the bill, but what if we had a dog that was being used for field trial, which might fall into this category of a violation, because you don't have to have a license to field trial a dog, and we have a lot of constituents that work dogs in a different way, and so I might want to...
Well, those... I guess some dogs are strictly for field trials, but,
yes.
You know, for the... Most of the people that we represent and stuff, if they're field trialed, they are hunted to a certain extent.
But I'm wondering if any particular event occurred. I wonder if we need to broaden this out just a little bit more.
Yes, I understand.
Vice Chair McKeown, the issue here is the illegal tethering, and typically when they're being field trialed, at least when they're in the trial, they're not tethered. They may have a check cord, depending on what class they're in, but typically would not be tethered. They wouldn't be field trialing at that point. So.
But Chair Witt, just to follow up, but I think what I'm concerned about is the time that the dog spends on the truck in the box.
In that instance, the dog is presumed in the presence of the owner or the handler, and that's provided for in the bill as well. So that would toll any illegal provisions as well.
Thank you for that clarification, and thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Representative Klum, please.
Just got one question I've been meaning to ask. Someone may have already asked it, and I missed it, about construction of the way the statute here. When in the list of things that you are doing that cause you to create the or commit the offense of a unlawful tethering, it's A, B, C, D, are those ors? There's no or, but they're semicolons. And so it's any one of those things? Or is it? I don't think it
There's,
can be all of those.
There, in the at the end of line 11, there is an or, representative.
So it's tethering and choke collar and more than 10 hours or 15 hours.
Yes.
Okay. So the semicolon is an and in lines 8, 10, and 11 functionally.
Mm-hmm. because the concern is, again, that leaving that animal for that period of time, or leaving them with the potential of being choked or pinched,
sure.
We're trying to avoid those specific kinds of circumstances.
So if I might just ask one more question. So just to get it completely clear, if they're tethered but the collar isn't a pinch or choke collar, then they could still be tethered for longer than 10 hours?
If they're longer than 10 hours, if they're on a run.
I think they're
there's an oar at the end of, I think they're all oars.
Yeah.
Well, there's only one oar.
Like when I first was reading it, I kept thinking about what if he just had a choke collar, and that's why I didn't wonder if it was
an animal. All right, what we'll do is we will have some of the folks that were in the work group come forward to actually propose that language. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Oops, I'm sorry. Would you hold on just for a second? I skipped over Vice Chair Esquivel.
Being a veterinarian, have you ever had a dog come in that's been tethered, that's had some sort of an injury or something from this?
No.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'd like to call up next, please, Jim Welch. And is there anyone else that would like to testify on the bill today?
Chair Witt. Committee members, Jim Welch here for Oregon Cattlemen Association. As the bill was originally written, we really had a lot of indigestion over, and we appreciate Dash 3. We're still staying neutral on this. We're not in a support position. There are probably some questions that you've heard brought up here today maybe need to be addressed, but I think our considerations, our concerns were taken, possibly taken care of here. You know, it really concerns us each session we keep coming in and having more and more rules around our animals. And certainly we have working dogs, and those considerations, you know, we're always watching for something that's going to overreach. And it's just a little disconcerting for us. And that's just a kind of a cautionary comment. And I know I've had that discussion with the chair. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Is there anyone from the work group that I know that there were members of the committee that had questions. Is there anyone that would like to come forward to answer questions? Please do. These are two of them here. So. Good morning. I don't know if you have any comments that you want to make, or whether you're just making yourselves available for questions.
I'm available for questions. I'm Wendy Reimer. I'm with the Oregon Humane Society. I'm one of the humane investigators.
Okay.
But I'm absolutely here to open for questions.
All right. Are there any further questions that members of the committee would like to have answered?
Did you
had a question about oars here a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Chair Witt, representative of the committee, Scott Beckstead, Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. With respect to Representative Clem's question, I think that provision in Section 2 is constructed to make sure it's clear that at no time can a dog be tethered with a chain or tether that is such a length that it presents a danger to the dog, and also makes clear that at no time may a dog be tethered with a pinch or choke collar. Then it goes on to say in section C and D to set the time limits. So these are not mutually exclusive provisions, but rather are cumulative and make clear that so C and D are joined by the or, and A and B are independent to show that at no time can a dog be tethered under those two conditions. Does that make sense?
Sorry. Yeah, it sounds lawyer. Are you? You're not a lawyer, are you? You are. See, and that's why. Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
So, just sorry. So, A and B. If you have a collar that pinches or chokes, but you're not on a tether, that's not covered under this bill.
No, I think it's unlawful tethering for a dog to be tethered with a collar that pinches or chokes. In other words,
tethers. Oh yes, tethers the master.
It's tied back to section 2, sub 1. A person commits the offense of unlawful tethering if the person tethers, and then goes on to say, A, with an unreasonable length, and B, with a collar that pinches or chokes. In other words, I think that the way it's constructed, a collar that pinches and chokes would be allowed if the dog is not tethered. In other words, if you're taking the dog for a walk.
Yeah, right. Plus you're in their control then.
But if it's tethered with a choke or pinch collar, then that would be unlawful tethering.
But if the reasonable length modifier is not in B, I just don't want you an accidental loophole either that says you can, you know, have a unreasonable length, I guess it would be. As long as you've got a choke collar on, you can still have it at an unreasonable length outside your control.
Yeah, I, again, Representative Clem and Chair Witt, I think the way it's constructed is to, again, make sure that the parameters are all within the tethering. So,
yeah.
Oh. Vice Chair, ask with
somebody's here.
So, run this by me again. I have a pit bull. I'm walking down the street. I can't have a choke collar on that even though I have him tethered.
No, you can because the dog is not tethered.
Well, I mean, if I have him on a leash, isn't that tethered?
No, tethering refers to affixing the dog to a stationary location.
Okay, so if I'm with the dog, it's cool. I don't want some pit bull to eat some other dog out there because I can't control him.
I think none of us want that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. It's going to be my intention to check with Legislative Council on where our ORs are so that we are exactly certain how this language is dealt with. And Representative Clem, thank you for that line of questioning. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2783. Thank you very much. Let's see here, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736. Beth, can you summarize those bills for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all of these bills were heard earlier this week, and you didn't quite finish the hearing. So House Bill 2319 would allow a person engaged in farming practices who believes that activities on nearby lands that contain genetically engineered materials interfering with their own farming practices through spreading. House Bill 2715 defines a commodity GE materials, GE organisms, and authorizes a county to establish one or more control area for commodities containing GE material. In 2736, would declare that a person is not liable for possession or use of genetically engineered plants if not in breach of a contract, and if they unknowingly came into possession of those plants.
Thank you very much. And we have four people left to testify from our last hearing. Scott Dahlman and Roger Beyer.
Okay.
And if it's possible to limit your testimony to 3 minutes, it would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Chair, not a problem. Thank you. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Seed Council. Both those organizations are opposed to all three of these bills, at least in their current form. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to go into great detail because I understand this. Very likely there will be another opportunity in a later time and maybe in a later hearing to get our specific concerns on the record. So with that, I'd just like to put on the record that the organizations are opposed to these bills, and we'll take an opportunity later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. Appreciate it. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're here today speaking in opposition of all three bills as well. And in the interest of time, you have some further written comments from me. And I understand, as Roger, that we may have an opportunity to express some more concerns on the record at a later date. So I will reserve the rest of my comments at this time.
Thank you so very much. Questions for our panel members? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I'd like to call up next, please, Jenna Jarvis and Jim Welch. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jenna Jarvis, here today on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I did submit some written testimony to you at the hearing on Tuesday, so I won't go into great detail. I do want to go on the record as saying that the Oregon Wheat Growers League is opposed to all three of these bills. Proponents of this legislation talked about on Tuesday that this would strengthen Oregon's Right to Farm Practices Act, and we are adamantly opposed to them because we believe it will weaken them, and we'll reserve the rest of our comments for another hearing. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Chair Witt, Jim Welch again for Oregon Cattlemen Association and committee members. We just very quickly want to say we want to be on record also opposing all three of these, and we feel that they would definitely interfere with some of our members' activities in agriculture. So thank you much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments?
No, thank you.
I'm not seeing any. Thank you both so very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on any of these three bills this morning?
I'd like to say something.
Okay. Vice Chair Esquivel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things I'd like to discuss here. One is that it was mentioned in prior hearings that Hawaii had passed something similar to this, and it's my understanding that the Attorney General of the State of Hawaii has determined that that's unconstitutional, so therefore it's null and void in Hawaii. The second thing is that an individual was talking about a person in Southern Oregon that had lost their crops. I think that needs a little solidification because I talked to an individual that had plowed up their crops and destroyed them. And I asked, first of all, how long had he been in the area? And he's within a quarter mile or so of a GMO sugar beet field. And he had been there 3 years, and the company had been there 14. So it wasn't the company moving in on him. He moved in on the company. The second thing is, he said that he'd plowed his crops under because of contamination. And I asked him if he had contacted the company, and he said he had, and they had said, if you bring certification in to prove that it has been contaminated, we'd be willing not only to pay for this year, but other years as well. The individual elected not to do that. Then what is interesting is that this amount of money that I hear every time on this issue keeps growing. I believe the first time I heard it was around $5,000 or so, $10,000. Now we're up to almost $20,000. So this is something I think that needs to be clarified in the record because I did talk to an individual that had lost their crops, according to him, but there is yet to be a certified contamination process in Jackson County. No one has been contaminated that has been certification that's shown that. So just for the record.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Esquivel. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736. I'm now going to open a work session on House Bill 2248. And Beth, if you could remind us what that bill was about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2248 was heard on February 28th. This is the bill that would amend statutes related to mineral mining to encompass additional types of mining and make a number of conforming amendments. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact, but if you review the statement, it does indicate that the Legislative Fiscal Office has requested a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means Committee for this bill.
Thank you very much. And again, it appears that if we send this bill any place, it's Joint Ways and Means from here. Let's see here. I will recognize Vice Chair McEwen, please.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 2248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion on her motion? I'm not seeing any. Is there... I'm going to ask for the clerk to call the roll, please.
Representative Whitsett.
No.
Representative Unger.
Right.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Speaker.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Estwell.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes, and the bill is sent to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2248. With that, I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3441. And we have, let's see here. I'm going to ask, first of all, let me see, how many people are 100 miles or greater distance today? Okay, so we don't have that concern. I'm going to ask up, please, first, Dennis Ritchie, Rich Angstrom, and Stan Steele. Good morning.
I should have had a bath.
Good morning. Welcome.
Chair Witt, members. My name is Dennis Ritchie. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Anglers and Oregon Anglers Research Society. We have our home base in Westland, but we represent members all up and down the Oregon coast and from the coast to the Cascades. We're now focusing most of our attention on ORS, our charitable corporation, which funds or finds funding for research and educational projects in the fisheries area. I'm privileged to have served on the Oregon Hatchery Research Center since its startup as vice chair its first year and the succeeding 2 years as chair. I support this bill, but I may lose my seat on the advisory committee because I'm going to let it all out during this testimony.
Okay.
Sorry. Gamble, whatever. I first want to say that our staff there is incredible. Dr. David Noakes and Ryan Couture and his crew are absolutely wonderful. But there's been a pervading feeling by fishermen, city and county leaders, and several legislators that we've not made progress toward the mission of the OHRC as we should. Questions arise whether the Scientific Advisory Board, OSU, or ODFW
are holding up progress, especially since Dr. Noakes is evaluated by both ODFW and OSU. The economic effect is that operationally, ODFW is strongly anti-hatchery. I've served on the Coastal Coho Recovery Plan and the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan as the sports fishing representative. Both plans have cut hatchery mitigation severely and impacted local economies. The Coastal Coho were cut by 80%, and the cuts are still being are still escalating in the valley. One frustration is that ODFW does not accept any of the positive hatchery research and recovery examples from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the tribes, or other states like Idaho. If we don't do it, it's not done. At a meeting of the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan, I introduced a most recent research report by U.S. Fish and Wildlife from the Abernathy Creek Research Facility just across the Columbia River. It showed that, by video, that hatchery smolt did not negatively affect wild smolt when the two of them were leaving the mainstream at the same time. It was exactly the opposite. The small wild fish drove the hatchery fish out of the best feeding and cover areas. However, this was the main reason ODFW at that time was saying we must reduce hatchery mitigation in the coastal, in the valley area. I was told my report was irrelevant and there were all kinds of research. I was shut out of the discussion at that point. I welcome a dependable funding base for the research center. I also believe that the reshuffling of the OHRC advisory board should help it regain its original mission. However, that board should meet at least quarterly. As chair, we started out meeting six times a year. That was too much. A lot of people traveled great distances. We cut it back to four times a year. That worked just about right. We were able to keep up with everything, both operationally and research-wise. It's somewhat ironic that now one of the research projects that we have taken up is a contract through the Corps of Engineers, and it's to invent and make hundreds of thousands surrogate spring Chinook. Now, a surrogate spring Chinook means it's a hatchery Chinook that acts like wild Chinook. That's exactly what the mission of the OHRC is. But it's somewhat ironic that if the Corps uses these to demonstrate that these fish can go down the dams without too much mortality, it means that they can push recovery of wild fish upstream over the dams, and they intend to stop all mitigation responsibilities, which will cut back our state hatcheries greatly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen? Welcome, Stan.
Members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele, Corvallis, Oregon. The Hatchery Research Center's concept and the dream of this creation of this facility was absolutely spot on when Director Ball, walking the grounds of a mothballed coho hatchery on a small coastal Oregon stream, realized that all of the discussion, the debate was large. It went from good science to bad science and whose science was either. And for Oregon to really responsibly manage its fisheries with all of the different things that are affecting those fisheries, we had to have answers. So I sat in a committee hearing, a remote committee hearing in LC, Oregon at the LC Community Grange, chaired by Representative Jensen. And we came in strong support as a local community of Alceans. in the area that I had been the game warden in for 25 years and now have a cabin in, and that's where we recreate. And we are in support because we realized that in 97, when we did away with 1 million coho smolts, based upon the fact that wild fish weren't doing well, we had to have answers. We needed to have those answers. So we supported the OHRC and continue to support it. 1.4 million angling license dollars a year are going to trying to find that answer. Those answers still elude us. They're a food fish. They're covered under ORS food fish laws and ORS wild game fish laws. So those answers have to be found if we're going to try to balance. I recently wrote a letter talking about balance, and some of the folks who aren't as interested in hatchery research said that was mythical, that trying to find balance is something that just isn't possible. It is. We can send a person to the moon in the 70s. We can attempt to identify what's causing problems with fish in the 21st century. I really fully believe that. I could go on for hours about it. It's a neat little facility. As Dennis Ritchie said, those personnel running that and operating it, you couldn't find better people. Ryan Couture is one of the best young biologists that I have ever worked with, and I've worked with a lot. He's truly just a gem. But we have to allow Ryan to make sure that facility runs at more than 20% capacity. We have to have research that we can apply to our hatcheries to answer questions. Because if we don't answer questions, and I'm going to leave it with this, the debate's just going to rage on, hatchery versus wild, and our economies and our sport fishing are going to be collateral damage. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. Folks may wonder why I'm involved in this. I'm involved in it from the landowner's perspective. And just a little bit about, most people see me as the mining lobbyist, but my background is in fish and wildlife and forestry, or my degrees, and I come from a gillnet family on the coast. I've been in Bristol Bay up in Alaska gillnetting. I've been on the Columbia from an old Swedish family, a generational family gillnetting, and I'm an avid sportsman. spent most of my time on the rivers and participating in all kinds of things, including significantly the salmon recovery effort that the state had. So I've kept track of this pretty closely. And wearing the OCAPA hat and not, you know, the Rich Angstrom with the fishing pole hat, one of the things that we feel pretty strongly about is this issue of recovering these species to the point where we can see some delisting down the road. And there's no question that the recovery of the wild fish is an important component of that. But the hatchery programs that we're trying to develop here can't be just about wild fish. They also have to be about production and producing enough fish for the sportsmen and the other natural resource industries that rely on fishing. And it works this way. You know, we're interested in the delisting aspect, for sure, with the wild, but what we see as landowners through, especially on the coast, for our gravel operations that we have there, is a lot of resistance on rivers where there aren't adequate, or the fish stocks are declined. And some of the fish groups come out and say, you know, maybe it's your fault, maybe it's forestry's fault, maybe it's ag's fault. But the point is we got to find in a balance with all of these competing interests, both from the wild side and from the production side. My role was helping making sure that the language in here was drafted in a manner that provided a complete circle of thought and accountability for the bill. And I did add a couple of changes to that. But the point of all of this is we need better communications, obviously. We need better accountability in how the program works. And it's going to lead to better decision-making. So we're supportive of this concept. We think it brings it back into what was intended. It'll help the landowner community in our goals in the long term. So thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you say we're only using 20% of the capacity of the hatchery. I believe that we have the largest hatchery in Southern Oregon, in the state of Oregon, and that's the Coal Rivers hatchery, and they're using less than 30% of that. So my suggestion at that time with the individual I was talking to is, why don't you take the salmon that you're taking and getting from the hatchery, and we're taking them back down to Tuvel Park, dumping them in the river, letting them come back through, and we recycle these for people to fish when we get our quota of eggs. I just still, it's hard for me to fathom why we don't take those eggs, fertilize those eggs, put them in a pen, and when they hatch, let them go. And I'll tell you why. Because if you have a million fish in there, little tiny guys, and only 5% return, gee, where I went to school, that's about 50,000. That's a pretty good run. But I think it's because they don't want that fish out there without the adipose fin being clipped. And I think that's the only reason.
That's one of the reasons. Another reason is...
Dennis, would you just please identify yourself? Thank you.
I'm sorry. Dennis Ritchie, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel. One of the reasons is that unfed fry released like that come back at 0.1% at best. Unless they're released in an area that's heavily fertilized with carcasses and that sort of thing. You just release them and many of them die within the first 24 hours.
Yes, my follow-up?
Please.
Yeah. I guess I'm still at so.
Yeah.
Some of them make it.
Some of them do make it, yes. But your other part of it is that, yes, then you have unclipped fish that can't be determined whether they're wild or hatchery. And right now, this state is paranoid over making sure all the hatchery fish are clipped.
Yeah, I think that's...
Stan Steele, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, and the members of the committee. You know, those are the questions. I think it's a great question, and that's what I want our science to be able to answer. A question like you have just raised. And, you know, I think that is where when they say, well, we have a board of laymen. I mean, why would they be able to look at this scientifically? And I think that's the great point, is we are going to look at our scientists and say, provide us with these answers. This facility is needed. The 20% needs to be taken into context, or not out of context, is the fact that the facility itself has never been operationally 100% with science. This is not a production facility similar to the other hatcheries. This is a research facility. So, you know, at any one time, they only have so many experiments going on there. And I think we need to understand that. That's what I was trying to refer to there. And there's been great angst amongst the people working there, is that they can't recruit more science. Well, we've taken numerous projects there and asked them, will you please invest, you know, find out an answer for us. And that's when some of the disconnect, and as Mr. Angstrom said, some of the communication breakdown occurs. And so when we conduct a three-year project checking the outgoing migration success of salmon, and specifically steelhead, and we see that we're losing 66% of them in 1 year to some unknown cause, it just begs the question, let's find the cause. And when we don't follow up that research with additional research to identify what mortality factor, what risk factor is there, that's where we see a great disconnect between science and adaptive management.
Rich. Okay, thank you very much. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dennis, at that hatchery and other facilities around the state, there's multiple type science going on, and there was a grant given, R&E grant, to Dr. Michael Bloom, and it had to do with genetics and steelhead.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the outcome of that was?
Sure. Dennis Ritchie, Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, members. Michael Bloom came to the OHRC in 2009 with a request for research at our facility. And we agreed to have that particular research done. For 2 years, he collected samples from the Siletz River and from the Alsi River. They took adult wild fish and spawned them in a hatchery situation, took the eggs, raised the eggs in a hatchery setting, and raised those smolt up to the point where they would have normally released them, but we can't release fish from the OHRC because we're not a production facility, so at that point they had to kill them all, but take the genetic samples. Yeah, I know. It bothers us too. But those genetic samples sat for some time, and so we asked Dr. Brown what the problem was. He came back to us and he said, we ran out of money. I've got all these samples that are frozen, but we don't have the money. So I went to the R&E board, which is fishermen's money from taxes, and asked for a $30,000 grant to pay for that. The person who spoke up was actually the Gillnetter representative on the board. He says, hey, we've got money in our part. I think this would benefit all of us. The intent was to identify the exact genes that are changed by raising them in the hatchery. Then we can go back and change the things in the hatchery so it doesn't happen. We thought, hey, this is wonderful. 6 months went by, and I kept bugging Michael Brown to get the results. And he said, oh, these things take time. They take time. 9 months went by, and he didn't answer my emails anymore. A year went by, and finally I turned to Dr. Noakes, and I said, hey, I need your help. Because if we don't get the answer or an answer, we're not going to get any more R&E grants for research. We need to know what happened to our money.
Mr. Ritchie, yes. when you made that inquiry, you made that inquiry as a board member?
I made the inquiry as a board member, actually.
Or while you were a board member?
I still am a board member. I was past chair at the time, and I said to Dr. Noakes, can you run interference for me and find out? And he said, Dr. Brown does need a little bit of prodding on that. I agree. And so about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Dr. Brown, and I asked him, okay, how did the research go? Where are we? He said, well, he said, actually, the results were unusable. I said, unusable? That's terrible. What happened? He said, well, they were inconclusive. And I said, inconclusive? We were looking to see if there were any genetic changes. Does inconclusive mean there were no genetic changes? That the hatchery didn't change any genetics in that year of raising? And he wouldn't answer me and cut the conversation short. 3 weeks later...
Dennis, would you...
yes.
Excuse me. I apologize here, but as a board member... How are you appointed to that board?
We are appointed by ODFW. Originally, I was appointed when the advisory committee was started. I have been reappointed twice, and my reappointment comes up again in a few months.
And as a board member, you are appointed to represent whom?
I am the sport fishing rep for the state.
And that board in general represents the public?
The overall board represents a wide swath of the public, yes.
If a board member has a question, I have to assume that it is the board that's guiding this research hatchery?
We were attempting to do that, yes, sir.
And... you're telling this committee that is of a board member and a representative, a member broadly of a board that represents the public, that the folks that you were appointed to oversee are not being responsive to your questions as a board member.
One of the scientists who came for permission to use our facility would not answer my question. That's correct.
Is there any reason to believe that your questioning or the questions that you posed were unreasonable or excessive?
No.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
The final conclusion to it was 3 weeks later when a major article was published in the Oregonian, I take it in other papers around the state, written by Dr. Blount and signed on by a number of ODFW people who helped him with the project and a few from undergraduate students from OSU. And it said in big headlines, hatcheries change genetics in 1 year. And the article went on about how the fish were changed as to being unfit. From wild parents, it talked about the Alsea collection, but then it went back to the old Hood River experiment, and he didn't say that his genetic test there proved it, but he went back to the data from the Hood River project, and the whole article was terribly misleading.
Thank you very much. Representative Krieger, I know you have more. I don't know if our other panel members would like to add something briefly.
Just real quick. We've been hearing about some of the discord for quite a while on this. Rich Angstrom, thank you, Chair Witt, for some time. But I want the committee to look at the bill as a new beginning and getting some of this past stuff behind us. I mean, it establishes the need for sure. But where we're headed is a better system that has better accountability, better communications, better reporting directions to both the director and the Fish and Wildlife Commission. When it's all said and done, that should be the focus for sure, is how we improve the system so we accomplish these goals that I talked about between wild fish and production and those kinds of things. So, even though you're going to hear some of that from probably some of the other folks on this, I'd encourage the committee to stay focused that we are trying to talk about the future and improving the system.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, committee members, I would totally second that. That is exactly, we can talk about the problems that we've witnessed and or felt have been occurring at the facility. But back to what Dennis did say, there's some incredibly current research, and I'm a research guy. I think all decisions have to be made on sound research. Sound policy decisions have to be based on science. So I reviewed the recent Nez Perce work on wild broodstock steelhead specifically. It's incredible work. It's work that we should replicate at our OHRC. Also reviewed a 58-year analysis of scale samples, the same thing Dennis was talking about, that Dr. Bluen was doing, off of British Columbia rivers. And what it found after 58 years was that there was no genetic differences that they could at that time with current science determine. What we're saying is we want that same type of research conducted at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center so that we can answer the questions, because we're best positioned to manage our fisheries. But I really do think that it is a new beginning. And the great thing about society is we're able to adjust. And that's what this is. It's just an adjustment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think Representative Krieger may have a follow-up question.
One question. Okay. Well, first of all, any scientist who gets a result that he doesn't agree with and then puts it in a drawer should be fired. That's the first thing, in my opinion. The second thing, you just brought up the issue of wild. You and I have talked about that in the Johnson Creek study. I'm not even saying it's perfect, but if you had wild stock, I'm not asking all three, but what you think it would mean is if we had the original answer to the main question of the research hatchery and you were able to reduce or nearly eliminate the negative effect of hatchery fish on wild fish because you change your hatchery management practices, then you marry that up with using only wild stock, what would be the potential for recovering endangered species and just about anything that you can think of?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, you know, that's an interesting thing. We, in 1999, actually, we invested a lot of federal dollars into that, getting to there, and it's called the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. And from that, there were 14 scientists that were actually assigned to the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, the tech committee. They analyzed exactly what you were just discussing. What is our best way to manage production facilities with the least amount of impact? And I call it it's a risk management. How do we identify the risks that we know we're going to have from hatcheries and best manage those risks to where we can have the least impact on wilds and still keep viable sport fishing opportunities and commercial fishing opportunities, the economic driver? And they came up with a list of six goals, and I included them in the handout today. And what they do say in there is that in conjunction with the native fish policy in Oregon, is that we can allow a certain percentage, depending upon what we use as broodstock parents. And when we're wild and wild, that percentage of stray rate that could potentially impact the wild population can be increased because they are first generations or the returning fish F1s. I'm not a biologist, but what I'm going to say is I'm going to go on the advice of not just Oregon's biologist, but of regional experts, and then synthesize the vast majority of what's out there and find best management practices. We can't be hidebound to where we think if it doesn't occur in Oregon, if it occurs at Abernathy, it's bad. If it occurs by the Nez Perce, it's bad. Confederated tribes have done some incredible research. We have to look at them as partners and understand that is how this thing's going to be driven to a balanced solution, not just thinking that our agency is the only one that has leading fish science. So my urge would be that we look at the OHRC as a part of a larger mechanism. It's Oregon's tool. And then we partner with all the other folks, whether it's the Northeast Atlantic Salmon Team that's done some incredible work on Atlantic salmon recovery. And we start drawing from these. Let's reinvest in making fish recoverable. We're never going to get to historic numbers, but we certainly can get to where they're viable going into the next 100 years of climate change.
Chair Witt and members, I have a packet of recovery stories that the tribes have achieved. What they do is they let all the fish come back to the spawning grounds. They collect all their spawners on the spawning grounds, and so it's a mixture of what had been in the hatchery last year and what were wild fish. It's a mixture. They don't worry about that, but they have had some phenomenal responses, and I'd like to just leave this with you to thumb through it as you may.
Well, thank you very much. And gentlemen, I want to thank you for your testimony, and I want to thank you for your advocacy for science. This committee wrestles with some very difficult issues. Canola, GM, hatchery production, and it goes on and on. Many of us don't have the benefit of a scientific background, I chief among them. If we are to make sound public policy, then we have to be able to rely on the best available science. This particular hatchery was developed to lead cutting-edge science in the development of hatchery stock. This committee, if it's to be able to make decisions, has to be able to rely on science. I thank you for the promotion of that, and I believe sincerely that our scientists want to conduct the best scientific research possible, and we want to become your ally and theirs as well. Thank you very much.
We want to thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Next, please, I'd like to call up Dan Edge, Carl Schreck, and Tom Wolf.
Do I have to sit with him?
I was going to say the same thing.
Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you so much for providing the opportunity for the testimony. My name is Dan Edge. I'm the department head in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University. I was on the original committee that began thinking about what this research center might be and how we might line it out and develop it into a world-class facility. And although I'm a wildlife biologist by training, I did learn a little bit about fisheries via my 8 years of service on the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So I'm passing around some prepared remarks, some written testimony, which has some of the details in it. I think I'd like to start by addressing some of the stuff that I've already heard today, one of which was I'm very surprised to hear that there's the perception of a anti-hatchery bias at OSU, which is just totally remarkable to me. Certainly there are science produced at OSU that suggests there are problems with hatcheries, and we all know that. That's why the center was developed. And so science progresses by testing and retesting. And so it doesn't surprise me that some of the results from OHRC work or from people not associated with OHRC indicates that there are some problems with hatcheries. We know that. I'm also surprised to hear that ODF&W apparently has a hatchery bias. They operate a bunch of hatcheries in this state, and you probably are aware that they are trying to respond to federal mandates associated with the Endangered Species Act in how they manage their hatcheries. So it's a highly evolving process. Excuse me. I guess my perception from what I was just hearing is that maybe when we developed the OHRC, there was a level of expectation which was not realistic. These are highly complex issues. We're talking lots of species under production in 25, 30 hatcheries in the state, all of which release fish into different systems which have endangered species problems, you know, wild fish problems associated with them. This is not an easy fix. We're not going to find a special fish where we're going to be able to release it and not cause problems. It will be a progressive process. The OHRC has been in operation for essentially a period of time of two life cycles of salmon. That's not a lot of time to resolve some of these sticky issues. So with that as a beginning place, I would also like to say that I'm surprised that the results of the OHRC wouldn't fit on a postage stamp. That's remarkable. The OHRC has produced at least 50 peer-reviewed publications, the scientists associated with it. The state invests about approximately $1.2 million per biennium in operating the center. That's the staff, that's keeping the water running, and the lights on. The scientists associated with the center bring in anywhere from $500,000 to $1.5 million per year in support of the research. I offer several other metrics of success, but I guess the bottom line is this is a extremely successful facility, and you heard the previous panel, we're all complimentary of the facility. I guess as a place to start, I would suggest that if there's a concern about the OHRC and whether or not it's fulfilling its mission, then really what you need is a comprehensive review, which is typical of scientific research centers, a comprehensive review that would look at the science that's been produced, would look at how the center is operated, would look at the advisory structure as a process. I think that's how you determine if the state's getting their best investment. I have offered a number of suggestions about the composition of the board. As I said, this is very complex issues. Many of them are highly technical. I think not having at least four scientists on the board, which our current advisory committee does, is a mistake. I don't mean to suggest that lay people can't completely understand that, but understand some of these issues. But some of them are very complex. And I think having scientists on the board provide the OHRC with the credibility that it needs in the scientific community. Let's see. So in Section 5, I have offered a number of suggestions about modifications that might be made from the standpoint of the goals. I think that section has a number of things which are highly restrictive in its language. These solutions are going to require some inventive approaches, and there are clauses in Section 5 which will restrict the kind of research that can be done, and I suspect will restrict the answers that we might need of our hatcheries in the future. I believe I heard Representative Krieger suggest that we'd resolve the issues I had with the Section 6, which was appointing a director. You heard very complimentary remarks about Dr. David Noakes today. He's what we call the senior scientist of the research school. He since functions as a director. His salary is paid half by Oregon State University and half by ODFMW. And if there are going to be appointments associated with that, I think OSU ought to have a say in it. Section 8 is not consistent with the biennial funding structure that both ODFMW and the State Board of Higher Education function under. This MOU with OSU is renegotiated every 2 years anyway, and the idea that halfway through a fiscal year we might renegotiate an agreement is problematic at best. So I guess in closing, I would suggest that this bill is premature. We don't have enough information about how effective the center is, and I would suggest a comprehensive review of the OHRC examining all these issues. Is the science good? Is the governing board good? Is it operated professionally? Those would be things that a comprehensive review would look at, and frankly, any science center anywhere would typically undergo, at least on a 10-year basis, those types of comprehensive reviews. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your interest in the OHRC. We heard some very positive things about it this morning. I'm pleased to hear that. And I can address any questions. Like I say, I'm not a fisheries biologist. My colleague next to me is one of the world leading fisheries biologists and probably can answer the technical stuff.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to get through your panel, and then we'll ask questions jointly of the three of you. Dr. Schreck, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Carl Schreck, and I'm actually testifying for myself, and I'd like to thank Representative Witt and the committee for listening to me this morning. And I'd like to start out by saying that I very much share the sentiments that I heard expressed by Representative Krieger this morning and also Senator Roebland with regard to the Hatchery Research Center. And my difficulties with the bill are more on the specifics and some of the nuances that I perceive might be in there and that could maybe lead to some difficulties down the road. It's not the philosophy that I heard expressed this morning. And I'd also like to thank Representative Witt and the three folks that testified earlier with regard to their support of science. Thank you very much for that. I've spent nearly 40 of my career years working on hatchery issues as a scientist and a fish biologist, studying fish in the hatcheries, also fish in the wild. And I do that as a faculty member at OSU and as a senior scientist for the U.S. Geological Survey. And before that, I worked for Fish and Wildlife Service and also was on the faculty of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. So my career is very heavily vested in science and trying to make hatcheries function better, either in a production sense or with less impact on wild fish. And I also, when I first started thinking about this, wondered where the view came from that OSU, in some folks' mind, had some bias against hatcheries or hatchery fish. I've never heard that expressed. I've never heard it expressed either on campus or by folks at the Hatchery Research Center. And, you know, just for example, the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife essentially did the fundamental work that allowed for productive shellfish culture on our coast. It's used today, it's been used in the past, it's used around the world. Faculty members started commercial salmon ranching operation that led to many fish for production, but also many fish that contributed to commercial fisheries as well as recreational fisheries. And we actually hired a commercial aquaculturist to run our laboratory at OSU. So it's just hard for me to envision that if we would do all that, that we have a bias against hatchery fish. I've published about 300 articles in my life, and most of those deal in some way with hatchery issues. And I don't think that, you know, that has also led to mine or my colleagues' perception that we're anti-aquaculture. So I want to assure you that we're really not. I also feel particularly qualified to speak about the OHRC because I'm a member of the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team and serve as co-chair of that. And I was chair of a workshop committee that was organized when the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife first came to us with this concept of needing some sort of facility to research these issues relevant to recovery of wild salmon. And please recognize that this was driven by the fact that there was an Endangered Species Act and Oregon decided that it would be important to take sort of homegrown control of the issues addressing that. And so when ODFNW came to us, we held a workshop, invited researchers, government scientists who were running research facilities, and also consultants, and it was a very broad array of folks dealing with these science sort of issues and facilities. And from that workshop came what then was to become the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. And so it was the design of the facility as well, but also a design of the operational plan, how the group would run. And we felt it was very important that there be some sort of advisory committee, and you heard mention of that earlier, that would help direct where that research would go. And one of the differences that I see in the proposed bill versus the way the advisory committee works is that the advisory committee is advisory. It was not called a board back then in terms of a governance board. It was referred to as an advisory board. And the reason being, basically, that it's to keep the science protected from the possibility of influence by special interest groups, and also to absolutely eliminate even the perception of any censorship. You know, there's just no room for censorship in science. And if there's a governance board that is made up largely of special interest groups, it's very hard for scientists to operate free from that. So I actually think that the whole system has worked very well. The OHRC is a real jewel in research. It really is. I spend a lot of time traveling throughout this country and internationally, and Oregon should be really, really proud of what we have and what that Hatchery Research Center has accomplished. It really is truly amazing. But that's not to say it can't do better. And I think, you know, that's why I appreciate the attention that you guys are focusing on this, because maybe there is a better way of doing this. I should mention that there is provision right now that every single proposal for work to be done at the Hatchery Research Center has to undergo a very rigorous review. It's a review that's of the science, but also how it fits within achieving the missions of the Hatchery Research Center. And I've provided for you in the written testimony a website you can go to if you want to follow that process. But basically, all the proposals of work to be done there do go through the advisory committee, and then see, you know, basically their input. But again, it's an advisory committee. My personal belief is what the science that is done should be left up to the scientists that are well-informed, and they should be well-informed by that advisory committee. That's the way it's supposed to work. Again, you don't want to have science driven by special interest groups and the possibility for some sort of science that is incredible because of that. I really do think the center has been an amazing operational success, and Dr. Edge has testified to that effect, so I won't repeat any of that. But I should also mention that while the Hatchery Center is addressing the issues that are germane to recovery planning and those sorts of issues of our salmonids, it really has led to a number of things that are very useful to other hatcheries as well. Even my own research that's been done there is leading to stuff that is being used by other state hatcheries or federal hatcheries. So there's a lot of spinoff that really does not really tend to get very much mention, but much of the work that's done there, yes, it's being done to help the hatchery wild issue, but has lots of other benefits that are being used. Should also mention that the research that's being done at the Hatchery Research Center has to be opportunistic. Scientists bring the money with them that drives this research. The state provides this base funding that Dan Edgett had mentioned. But basically, doing research is expensive. And it's very difficult, believe it or not, for a scientist to come up with a wonderful idea and get somebody to fund it just because it's a wonderful idea. Basically, scientists address requests for proposals and then try to find some way of having it fit what they think are important objectives. So the money that Dr. Edge mentioned comes to the center each year from the scientists basically is in response to just being opportunistic. So it's very difficult to, for example, write a request for proposals from the center, and if there isn't some sort of money behind it, there'd be no reason for people to write proposals. Having the facility is one thing. Having the money to do the work is another. The OHRC also provides tons of other benefits relative to education in general and outreach, and that should not be ignored as well. I really do think that the present advisory board has the capacity to do everything that this bill suggests that a governance board should do. One of the things that I think is important with regard to the notion of funding, I very much like your idea of having some sort of Hatchery Research Center fund. I think that's just a wonderful idea. There's another way of doing that. That could be done through the OSU Foundation type of system without having to involve the entire legislature. There's sort of a ready provision for that sort of thing. I would very much encourage you, so there's just no confusion, that if you do create this type of fund, that you separate out the money that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is providing for base operations from possible research funding that I would envision that you intended for this fund to do. So that's one area that maybe could be somewhat clarified. So again, thank you very much for your attention, and I would offer that if I can help you with any sort of technical issues either now or in the future, please don't hesitate to call on me. Thank you.
Thank you for that offer, and thank you for your testimony. Tom.
Chair Witt, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and Trout Unlimited is cautiously supportive of this bill. I was approached a while ago by two people that I really respect. I don't always agree with them on everything, but I really respect them, as Joe Rolater and Representative Krieger, about this bill, and sat in a group of people that I often disagree with, but also respect, such as Dennis Ritchie and others, looked at the changes. I think these are good changes. We should look at what the concepts that are being discussed in this bill, and look at the changes that are going to be made. And before I go on to the rest of my testimony, I want to preface by saying that I have nothing but respect for ODFW as an agency. I have nothing but respect for Oregon State University, since I'm a graduate of that university. I'm go Beavers. It's interesting that some of the previous panels said that they perceive ODFW and OSU as being, and I'll try to be quick on this because there's other people after me, as being anti-hatchery. Trout Unlimited and the wild fish people, we view ODFW and OSU as being pro-hatchery. And we see that as a very different thing. So that always means what this brings up is the fact that a lot of people in the 20 years that I've been working on fish issues in Oregon is a lot of people are upset at ODFW. It doesn't matter if you're pro hatchery, if you're wild fish, whatever. There's a lot of anger out there about this, and maybe a bill is not the best way to resolve some of these issues. Maybe we need to have, as Dan Edge suggested, some sort of review. Maybe we need to have an advisory committee. But there needs to be a way that we can fix some of the problems here. Because I think having a research hatchery that is cutting edge is a great thing. ODFW no longer has a research department. The research center is it. We need to look at ways that we can study interaction of hatchery fish and wild fish to cut back on that. We also need to understand how do we improve the survivability of wild fish. There's a lot of things that can be dealt with there, and we need to look at ways to answer that so that both the people like the wildfish advocates like TU, the people that Dennis Ritchie and others represent can be happy with the results. And it needs to be fixed so that we don't come up with bills that try to deal with this and in good and but there are answers out there that we can fix this, that we can make everybody happy. And I just suggest that we look at some sort of advisory committee, some sort of review, so that we can answer the concerns of the pro-hatchery people. We can answer the concerns of the wild people. We can actually make this research center even better, because it's already done good work, but it can always, everything can be improved. So let's look at that. Let's look at ways that we can change this. Let's look at ways that we can make this a better thing. Let's come up with answers so that we can go forward and look for common solutions and not keep fighting with each other. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, before I open it up for questions, I just want to remind you that we have three panels left to go, and time is running short. So if we could, the most critical questions. Do we have anything for this panel? Yes, please, Representative Krieger.
It might be well if Dan, you spent some time in my office with a cup of coffee.
Be glad to do that. Be my pleasure.
Okay.
It, for the record, thank you for please. The invitation.
Representative Witsa, and then Vice Chair Esquivel.
I just have a comment. Gentlemen, I'm also a graduate of Oregon State University with two of my degrees in scientific disciplines, and in federal public testimony on the Klamath fisheries, my husband, Senator Whitsitt, and I both heard a PhD out of Oregon State say, quote, "The truth is whatever you want it to be." And it's disturbing to me to hear something like that, and it stuck with me for a long, long time, and I just want that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
I guess the thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the one question that has not been answered here is how that advisory board member could not get any information out. Now, I don't care about the science part of it. That's your bag. I don't care about ODF&W's part. But when a person from the advisory board cannot get information and gets put off until they're frustrated like that man was, you've got a problem in this hatchery system.
You can leave it as a comment, or you can respond to it as
your There's no question goal. There. I'm just making a statement.
I'll leave it as a comment.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further for our distinguished panel?
No. I have to ask.
Representative Reardon, please.
Could someone explain to me the how we came up with this proposed makeup for this board? It doesn't appear to me to be very... If we're looking for scientific answers, this makeup of this board doesn't look to have very many scientific credentials necessarily. So could somebody explain that to me?
If that is an awkward question for you gentlemen, I would understand it.
This may not be the right panel. I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that. I have no idea where it came from.
I can get together with Representative Reardon and explain
I appreciate
to
that.
What's going on.
Thank you very much. Please,
Schreck. Carl Schreck, in response to that question, I don't know where the current makeup sort of originated in the very beginning either, but the present advisory committee represents the federal government, agriculture resources, timber, gravel, local government, watershed council, conservation, sport fishing, commercial fishing, the public at large, and science at large. And I believe there's 13 members on that, so it's actually quite broad the way that it is now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm not seeing anything further. Gentlemen, appreciate your testimony. Appreciate the great job that you're trying to do in advising us on the science that surrounds the fisheries management. Appreciate it. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Kurt Melcher. Kurt, don't feel compelled to be loquacious today.
I'm a panel of one?
Panel of one, Chair Witt.
That's correct.
Be very brief, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With regard to House Bill 3441, and like I said, I will be very brief here. We have been working over the last several weeks with the chief sponsors, in fact, Representative Krieger, to address many of the issues and inconsistencies that we saw with the bill. Many of those have been addressed. We do, and I think Representative Krieger mentioned some of the additional ones are in the process of being addressed with regard to the use of the word pure wild in one section, as well as our recommendation that OSU be involved in the hiring of the director. That I understand those are being addressed as well. We did also mention that we felt that there should be some scientific representation, as Representative Reardon had mentioned here on the committee. I understand that's not in the bill currently, but it was something that we did recognize. And then lastly, I would just speak very briefly to the fiscal impact on associated with this bill. Since we have a current advisory committee in place that we are staffing, they're meeting four times per year. With the passage of House Bill 3441, we would, of course, dissolve that advisory committee and then redirect our efforts that we're going into coordinating and working that advisory committee into the new statutory advisory board. So from our perspective on the fiscal side, it's minimal, minimal fiscal.
All right.
Happy to answer any questions if anyone has any, but I understand you have other folks that want to testify as well.
Just one real quick one.
All right.
Minimal fiscal, but yes, it's going to Ways and Means. We need to find out why there's a fiscal on it, because it was designed not to have one.
Very good point, Representative Krieger. Thank you. So noted.
Yeah, Chair Witt, I did review our fiscal, and it did say minimal. There was no...
Okay.
So I'm not sure why the referral.
Thank you very much. The mysteries of this process. Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate it. Next, please, Jim Myron, Sean Miller, and Mark Landauer. And gentlemen, with 5 minutes to go, awards go to the shortest testimony.
Any former auctioneers here?
Well, I guess I'll start. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I represent the Native Fish Society. I put down that we were neutral on this bill, and what I want to do is make it clear that we've had an open door to Representative Krieger's office and Joe Rollator to work on issues over the last several weeks on this bill. We are supportive of the concept of putting some statutory direction in place relative to this body. We see nothing wrong with putting something in statute that gives a basis for the operation of the Hatchery Research Center. The rest of it is still kind of a moving target, and we anticipate being involved in the discussions as well. We hope that what this will lead to is a resurrection of a stronger science a capability within the Department of Fish and Wildlife. 15 years ago, we were very disappointed when ODFW decided to close their research division, and since then, it's just been kind of a hodgepodge. So we see this as the potential of resurrecting a strong research component within the agency that will not only do research, but research that affects policy.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Coastal Conservation Association, and I'll be brief. I'll submit my written comments to the administrator. But we do support this the science-based efforts to reform the hatchery operations consistent with ongoing salmon recovery efforts, and welcomes this critical scientific input in a redirected hatchery research center could provide. And so I want to thank Representative Krieger for spearheading this, the chair for hearing this, and that will conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association. Communities and ports along the coast depend and rely on healthy stocks of both wild and hatchery salmon and steelhead. We want to voice our support for House Bill 3441. We want to ensure that the best possible science is brought forward. And with that, I'll just simply conclude my testimony. Much has already been said. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Anyone? Gentlemen, I appreciate the brevity of your comments and appreciate your testifying. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Norm Ritchie, Jim Welch, and Tom Davies. And Joe Rollator, if you'll come up and perhaps sit right behind them, we're going to run you right through here real quick, too.
It's Davis.
Davis, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair Witt and the members of the committee. My name is Tom Davis. I was one of the original advisory committee members when the OHRC opened. I served two terms, beat my head against the wall a lot. I saw a lot of things, and I'd like to tell you about a few of them, and it's not going to be short.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask that it be short. I apologize. Or I'm going to have to ask that you come back another day. I've got 2 minutes.
Can you schedule another time?
Yeah. We can do that.
I would defer to that.
All right. Thank you. And I apologize.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee member Jim Welch here for Oregon Cattlemen Association. We support this bill. We support good science and research. And the healthier our fish are, the healthier we feel we will be upstream. And so we are very much in support and have been in the past on these types of efforts. Thank you very much.
Good morning, sir. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee. My name is Norm Ritchie. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, and I am also currently a member of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Advisory Committee. Northwest Steelheaders has supported the Hatchery Research Center and continues to do so, but we are concerned that the work being done is not adequately focused on the hatchery influences on wild production. The Northwest Steelheaders is currently an intervener in a court case in support of ODFW and the Sandy River Hatchery. In that court case, there have been a lot of technical papers, research studies identified and pointed to on both sides. Of the 50 plus research reports mentioned by Dan Edge, none of them came from the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. So our concern is that it really isn't focusing on what we need to be looking at.
Thank you very much. Since we're going to continue the hearing, if you want to come back, any of you with additional testimony, we'd be welcome to take it the next hearing. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Mr. Davis, I apologize that we've run out of time, but we'll look forward to you the next time. Joe Rollator, if you'd come up, please, we'd appreciate that. Committee members, I understand if some of you need to run. My apologies.
Members of the committee, Chair Witt, I'm Joe Rollator. I live on the Owl Sea. I've been associated with this hatchery and this river since it's started. I'm drafting a Dash 2 amendment, and I would rather come back and explain to you what the Dash 2 amendment does, because it actually takes care of a number of the technical issues that have been raised by this very well-informed panel. And I just have one thing I want to tell you, and that is that the hatchery's done some pretty good research. It's also done some pretty crappy research. But the perception amongst fishermen and women is that the OHRC needs to be redirected to conduct research to minimize the risk between naturally produced fish and hatchery-produced fish while maintaining hatchery production. We're not going to get to fish if we don't have hatchery fish. And the hatchery fish have to produce the very smallest risk to wild fish possible.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to announce for everyone's, Joe, I appreciate that. Thank you. When your amendment is ready, you and Representative Krieger will let us know, and I'm going to carry over the hearing until such time as we're prepared to hear the amendment. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3441, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much.